This is Business of Home. I'm your host, Dennis Scully. Every week, I'll be talking with leaders and innovators from all corners of the home industry. My guest this week is Shannon Campanaro, the founder and creative director of SKL. After studying fine arts at the prestigious Central St. Martin's in London, Shannon landed a job creating patterns and designs for the apparel brand Express. Eager to change up her space after an ex-boyfriend moved out, Shannon experimented with turning some of her designs into wallpaper. And a few years later, she found she had a business. Today, her textiles, wallpapers, and custom rugs are highly sought after by designers and showrooms around the country. And just this spring, home furnishings retailer Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams partnered with Shannon to bring a special collection of SKL wallpapers to their stores. In a wide-ranging and candid conversation, I spoke with Shannon about everything from sample costs to exclusivity agreements, why she's eager to build her custom rug business, and how the comfort of knowing she has a plan allows her not to worry about a possible recession. This podcast is sponsored by Modern Matter, designer of handcrafted and luxurious hardware. Small details can completely change an interior. When designing a space, consider the importance of hardware at the beginning of your design plan. Elegant and timeless hardware makes an impact on any room. Modern Matter offers a customizable collection of solid brass hardware featuring hand-polished gemstones. Choose from over 500 knobs, pulls, and backplates in stock and ready to ship. Visit modernmatter.com to see how the company is redefining hardware. That's modern-matter.com. This podcast is also sponsored by High Point Market, the premier home furnishing show with over 11.5 million square feet of showroom space and 2,000 exhibitors. Twice a year, 75,000 professionals from around the world flock to the home of home furnishings for 5 days of exploring, buying, learning, and networking. Fall Market is October 22nd through the 26th. It's a can't-miss event for retail buyers and interior designers, so be sure to register now at highpointmarket.org. And now, on with the show. What's funny when you research SKL, it's amazing how often the headline in a story will be beloved cult brand SKL.
Really? Right? That's cool.
Yeah. And so I'm curious where that came from or what your perception of that. I love that you're thought of as this cool cult brand. And what's that about?
I love that too.
Well, and it made me think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't you originally trying to create a streetwear brand and a whole sort of look, right? Wasn't that the early days of—
Before it was this, it was, I mean, I collected sneakers. I had like 150 pairs of Nikes and I was trying to make t-shirts and, but I like it so much too, because whenever we talk about our growth, I always think like, I want to grow, but I don't want to be seen as big. And I used to think about that a lot because we have a lot of patterns. We have a really big catalog. And a lot of times, especially in the past, people would assume that we were a lot bigger than we actually were. I think just because of the amount of patterns we had, you know, like, they'd be like, can we talk to your customer service department? I'm like,
you're speaking to her right now, as a matter of fact.
You can talk to me. And then at some point I'd be like, well, I made the pattern. I'm actually the designer. And they'd be like, oh my God, what? But I want to seem like a discovery. I think we actually sit in the marketplace kind of in that way. Like we've never been like the hype brand. Like this is the next new thing that everyone's hyped on. And I hope that we can maintain that as we grow. That's really important to me. I always mention it every year in our goals.
Let's set the table for listeners and give them a little bit of an introduction into SKL and what the work that you do is all about. So we mentioned back in the day with the 150 pairs of sneakers and the brand, but really what we know today as SKL, it sounds like, was really born out of you experimenting with some things in your own space. Tell us in your own words.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, I was experimenting with wallpaper. I made some wallpaper for some art exhibitions that I was in. Actually, it's a funny story, which I don't think I told you before, but I had been living with a boyfriend that I was with the first maybe 3, 4 years that I lived in New York, and we broke up and he moved out. And when he moved out, I was like, I'm getting rid of all this furniture. So I just kind of had this empty apartment. And then I was like, oh, I'll make wallpaper for this wall. It was like a bump out wall in the living room. So I basically made wallpaper for the wall and it was like empty. I just had like a rug. I think I had a TV in the corner and maybe like a cushion or something, and then this wallpaper. So I did that. And then it was a couple years later when I decided to actually create a line, because I was not that into wallpaper, to be honest, as a design thing. I don't think wallpaper was very popular back then. And I was like, I want to see if I actually like this, like if I actually continue to like it. Like, I'm going to do it now, but will I like it next year or will I like it the year after? And it was like the one thing that everybody complimented when they came in to my house, which eventually had more furniture.
When they came into your empty home and they said, "Hey, I can't help but notice these walls since there's nothing else for the eye to to." Well, and we should tell listeners that it's not as if you just randomly started doing wallpaper. You went to school for, let's
Oh,
tell
yeah.
people a little bit of your background and education so that they can understand that you're actually quite a talented artist on many levels.
Yeah, my background is in fine art. I got my bachelor's of fine art at Central Saint Martins in London, and then I moved to New York shortly after that. And because it's actually quite difficult to find a job with a bachelor's of fine art or to make money selling paintings instantly after art
Not
school.
to discourage those who want to pursue that, but it's not always
It's not the easiest path in life, but I
right.
sort of immediately fell into design. So, and also because, you know, Central Saint Martins is quite famous for fashion. So I ended up working in design and fashion, doing fashion graphics. And also, I did a lot of like party flyers and club flyers. And then I was interested in t-shirt design, as I had mentioned. So I designed t-shirts for some people, and we threw art shows. When I first moved to New York, me and my best friend, we would organize these big art exhibitions where all the art was auctioned off for environmental charities. But I think I am actually truly a designer at heart. And maybe if I would have realized that, I would have studied design, but I didn't know much about design growing up, so I chose art.
Well, and it sounds like as you've said before that you really didn't know design or designers or this whole world that you find yourself so deeply immersed in today.
I had no idea about it, and I'm so thankful that I found it. I do remember when I was really young, like my parents are pretty religious, and I would sit in church and draw, and I would always say, I would draw like wedding dresses or rooms, and I would be like, I want to be an interior designer or a fashion designer.
And what would your parents say when you said that?
I mean, they're very encouraging. My parents actually own a fitness company, but both of them took painting classes.
Well, and do I remember correctly that your father, I mean, didn't your father invent the total gym?
Yeah, he was a bodybuilder. He did bodybuilding with like Arnold Schwarzenegger and all the famous people until they started doing steroids, because he's actually a real health nut. He sort of had to quit.
Oh, so he didn't want to be any part of that.
Yeah, he couldn't compete after that. My dad's company found great success when I was in college because they got an infomercial deal, and the infomercial company got Chuck Norris and Christie Brinkley to represent
Christie Brinkley,
the
that's
product.
right, to do the Total Gym ads. I remember. I used to own a Total Gym, so
Really?
I, oh my God, yes, I loved the Total Gym.
That's so cool. Yeah, I mean, they still it's still a family business. My brother's running it
Amazing.
now, and the infomercial is actually it's the longest running infomercial in like the
Still
history
running.
of the world.
So, and did you ever think, oh, I'll go to the family business? Was that ever a thought?
No. No. I mean, I did work there. I mean, I worked there. I worked in every single department growing up, and I learned a lot. I mean, I learned a lot of things like that I wouldn't want to do. I mean, I learned in things like, oh, I want to have a business where I don't have stock, so I don't get stuck with inventory that I can't move, which is what gave me the idea to make products to order, which it turns out is totally standard in our industry. And I don't know, I saw them also go through growth. I think I saw them go through, well, they had a really big issue with being like a sort of small rehab company. And then when they got the infomercial deal, they sort of like had extreme growth, which I think was really hard to manage. It made like a lot of things like fall through the cracks when you grow really fast. So it always made me not want to have a company that grew too fast.
Well, that's so interesting. So is that part of why you didn't want to grow too quickly when you were talking earlier about not wanting to be too big? You saw what happened there?
I think now that you mention it, yeah, I think that is a big thing. They also lost their company and went completely bankrupt when I was between the ages of like 9 and 12. And had to buy it back. They actually made a deal and like the contract was breached and the brand was completely let to die and they ended up having to buy it back.
So interestingly, you absorbed knowledge and experience about business during that time. No, no question, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think I absorbed a lot of knowledge in business. And then I also think I have a kind of a unique relationship with my family. Wherein, like, I was sort of the black sheep. Like, I ran away from home when I was young, and then I was the one who was the artist, and I went like off to reform school, and then I moved to Europe for like 6 or 7 years, and I kind of was like avoiding the family because I felt like I stuck out. Like, they're also all very conservative, and I'm more liberal. So I think in a lot of ways, I was like, I'm gonna do something different. But now that I'm older and wiser, I mean, yeah, I learned so much. Even if I learned what not to do, I learned so much. And I find that they were similar to me and that they were just trying to figure it out the whole time. And I think that I inherited like the fascination with trying to figure out how a business works. Like, I'm totally fascinated with it. Whether I'm doing it the way they did it or not, it's a fascinating subject for me. My mom and I have a lot of that in common because she ended up having to do a lot of human resources herself. She was a human resources person. She had to learn teach herself that. And she has like this tool that she uses to have like employees take these tests that show you how they work. And she's taught me all that. And I'm like fascinated by like how to give people jobs that they'll be satisfied with, which means you'll also get a high amount of productivity from them.
Well, so do you have a whole questionnaire that you ask people when they come?
It's this thing called the predictive index, and I pay for it and I learned how to read it, and it's amazing because there's all different things that will drive people, and if you give people work that sort of satisfies their biggest drives, you'll get the most out of them and they'll be happy. And I actually personally am very much driven by like having a harmonious sort of like relationships around me. So for me, I really care that my employees are happy. And I feel like if they're happy, I get the best work out of them.
Sure, there's a lot to be said for happy employees.
Yeah, but like for example, some people wouldn't be happy speaking to customers all day, and other people wouldn't be happy retouching photos all day because one thing is very like extroverted and one thing is very introverted. So you have to like find the right person for the right task. People have different styles of working.
Exactly. And so often the simple act of pointing that out and explaining it can make such a difference, right? Because
It
once
makes
people
a huge
understand,
difference because some people get people get frustrated with their coworkers for this or that, and I'm like, well, you're perfect for your job because you're like this, but they're perfect for their job because they have to like sit there all day and like do the same thing over and over again by retouching photos, or like a lot of the technical stuff in the production side requires like following the same process over and over again. So we want to make sure that people in those positions like enjoy that kind of work.
well, when people talk to me about you, one of the things that they say is, "Oh, she does things her own way. She's got her own way of running the business, and it's really interesting." And I think that is something that you have sort of found your own way. You sort of walked into this business not knowing anything, right, about the interior design industry and what the dynamic was like. And let's go back to those early days when people were loving your wallpaper and you took a chance on moving forward with that. Tell us the evolution of how you progressed along.
Well, we started with wallpaper, and I'll give you a really funny example of how much I did not know. So I wanted to make the wallpaper all completely custom because I also wanted to reduce waste. So I said, you know, we could do custom scale and any width or length or whatever. And then I quickly realized that if you want wallpaper to match up, you have to have a standard width. You can't have different widths because then the paper hanger can't like match it up when you're
sure.
doing it. So the width has to be standard. So that was something I learned really quick. But yeah, I mean, I didn't know about showrooms. I didn't know about trade discounts. I didn't know about secrecy with pricing. I didn't know about free samples. I could tell you another big mistake that I made early on.
Please.
So I still had my job at Express. I would deal with any phone calls on my lunch break. And I remember the office was near Union Square and it was like the dead of winter. And there was like a snowstorm. It was like sleet raining on me. I was in Union Square on the phone with this client who's this client's wallpaper installer who was freaking out because the client was a celebrity, like a huge celebrity that everyone
huge
knows.
Huge celebrity.
Okay. Everyone knows the celebrity. But I can't say who it was.
Whose initials are...
a musician.
Okay.
Anyway, the wallpaper installer was like, only half the paper's here. And they ordered for the full room. And I was like, I don't understand. Like, they gave me the measurements of this... They gave me the measurements for two walls. And I gave them paper for those two walls. I never asked, like, is this for the whole room?
Are there other walls in that room? Perhaps it is just a two-walled room.
It happens all the time. Like, people will give you the measurements for a whole room, but they'll just give you, like, the two walls, and they want the whole room. But it also happens that people just order wallpaper for one wall or two walls.
Or an accent wall, sure.
Yeah, but I was, like, so inexperienced. They were like, this celebrity is so important. You have to send the rest of the paper. And, of course, like, they wanted the rest of it for free because they were only charged for the two walls. So
right.
I ended up paying, and this is before FKL made any money. I was working a full-time job at Express, you know. So I ended up paying for this celebrity's wallpaper myself. So the first thing I tell any salesperson is ask if it's for the whole room or just these walls.
Ask how many walls are in that room and then make sure we've accounted for all of them. So people are catching on to the wallpaper. You quit your day job. You get some money from mom and dad. You show at Brooklyn Design. Eventually, you show at ICFF and get a lot of attention there, right? And interior design is writing about you, and you're starting to get a following. And you mentioned that one of the early things you did, in part because it was a friend, was you had a PR person working with you, and that really helped get the word out in the early days. Tell me some of the other decisions that you began to make as the business began to grow.
So yeah, I don't think we showed at ICFF yet. Well, we did Brooklyn Designs a couple of years because it wasn't too expensive. And I don't know exactly how to bring up this topic, but yeah, we talked about it before. And it's just like something that Grace Bonney one time interviewed me in. And or actually, you know, it was very early on. Grace Bonney from Design Sponge, she was a really supportive, and she had this luncheon with a bunch of young designers, and she always told me she remembered this about me. And we were at a luncheon, and everyone was talking about sampling and how expensive it was and how to manage that, because that was really the only expense I had in the beginning, aside from development expenses.
Was sampling.
Yeah, sampling. And yeah. In the, you know, all the big companies give away free wallpaper samples. And it's also, if you're cutting wallpaper samples from patterns, there's a lot of waste because not every cut will have all the colors or be a good representation of the pattern.
Yeah.
So the first thing we developed or decided to do was to print our samples digitally, where we just printed the same section over and over again. And we also, since we were printing digitally, we printed the label. So we didn't have to label it by hand. We didn't have to stamp it or staple anything or produce something to staple onto the sample that would be more wasteful. So we were making our samples to order and they were labeled and they were the perfect part of the pattern, but it was kind of expensive. And I just remember one time I got sample order and I was basically like, I'll charge people the cost, the sample, and that should be fine. I mean, it's the cost, right? And then I got some really like attitude driven pushback from a client who called me up. They're like, I don't pay for samples, blah, 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 blah. If you want to be in this project, you'll send me the samples, blah, blah, blah. And I just remember like I had my credit card was maxed. I had like used up my loan money. Nick was paying for everything, basically like rent and food. I didn't turn a profit with SKL yet. And I just told the lady, I said, look, I said, I actually can't afford to buy the sample right now. So either you're going to buy it or I'm going to buy it, but I can't. So if you want the sample, you have to pay for it. And I remember telling this story to Grace Bonnie at this luncheon and everyone was like, what? Like so shocked. So anyway, yeah, that was a big thing that we basically had samples for sale and we basically had to charge for samples because I literally couldn't make the samples without having some kind of income to pay for them. And I just didn't have the income yet. And I think that's happened throughout the years too, where people have asked to be given like special service. And I've been like, look, you know, it's going to go on my personal credit card or it's going to go on yours. But like, I'm just a young person trying to start a business and I don't actually have like any funding or any money or, you know, I think you're the one who wants the wallpaper. I mean, maybe you could pay for the sample. So that was a big thing. And then I would say like, yeah, samples are our biggest cost, samples and shipping. That's another one actually, just having a website that doesn't offer free shipping in this day and age is like, people are just used to everybody offering them free shipping,
right?
Which we don't offer. I think it's crazy actually that you're expected to give out the amount of samples for free and also the amount of samples that you'd be giving out if you gave out your whole line. You know, that's another thing we do is we ask people to really like specify four projects and really like be conscious of what they're specifying because we don't want our samples to go to waste and because they are an expense. So we actually talk to our clients all the time about that. You know, if we get a huge sample request for like 30 or 40 samples, you know, we ask them like, is this for your library or is this for a specific project? And if it's for your library, you know, we please ask that you order them on our website because it's really hard to keep track of that stuff on the phone or, and then on the website, we ask them to pay and we offer them a discount code for designers, you know, which basically ends up covering our costs.
Right. And that's what you're hoping. You're hoping that you can just charge enough for samples and that you can just cover the cost. It's not like you're looking for it to be a profit center. It's just neutralizing that cost.
Basically, by having samples available on the website in a way that's really easy to shop. For example, we have on our product grid, like a little tab that sort of like, it just pops up if you hover. You can literally just add samples to your cart without even clicking into the product. And that was something we developed really early on because we wanted to make it really easy for designers to shop for samples. I think because of that, a lot of people just order online. And then we have retail people who pay regular price for samples, which is a little more than cost. And somehow it all manages to sort of cover our sampling costs at the end of the year so that we end up kind of breaking even.
Well, and that's huge. And it's so interesting to hear how you've managed to do that, because as we say, that is usually the biggest cost, particularly for the smaller companies is to pay for the sampling and the shipping and all of that. So it's interesting that between the retail customers, and I know you don't have a ton of retail customers, but you have some, and they pay what they pay, and then designers that order online pay for samples, or sometimes if you have showroom relationships, it sounds like you have to navigate that.
Yeah, I mean, we also have our showrooms pay the cost for the samples. I know some of them pass the charge on to their clients and some of them give the samples out for free because that's in line with what they do anyway. It's also like a labor thing. Like if you have people writing you an email with like a huge list of samples, you have to sort of like organize that. Or if you have people calling all the time with a huge list of samples, you have to like make sure you take the right notes and make sure you have the correct address. If people order online, if you direct people to order on the website, you basically get all that information in a really tight, sort of organized manner. It makes it a lot easier for our sample person. And we have a full-time person who handles all of our sampling, and that's her only job. She maintains like our sample inventory. She cuts the samples that need to be cut. She sends everything out. She makes sure everyone who orders is in our CRM. And yeah, we have a program with any new showrooms that they essentially pay for their samples and their setup. I would say that's like the second biggest cost that small companies have to deal with. That isn't that I didn't find to be basically, I wasn't seeing the return on setting up showrooms. Basically, anyone who wanted, they're like, oh, we want to represent SKL. Like, great. Here's 30 drops of fabric and like 40 rolls of wallpaper and a giant package of samples, which all ends up costing a ton of money, and then not getting any sales, or getting some sales, but not a lot compared to how many we're getting direct. First, we decided to stop courting showrooms, and then we decided to stop taking new showrooms. And then eventually, we made up a sort of like we have a PDF document that we give to showrooms who are interested in carrying us. And we basically just pass the cost along to them for them to set up with us. And the only reason why we did this too is like in the very beginning, we did very well with Studio Four because they kind of knew what they were doing. I think they might have done like third of our business.
Studio 4 is your showroom in New York, we should say for listeners. So Studio 4 is your showroom in New York, and that was your first showroom, if I recall. Yes?
Yeah, they started, I think, in the same year that SKL started or the year after. So they were new, we were new, and it was a really cool relationship. And they taught us a lot of what we learned about the interior design industry. And we still work with them, and they're still our biggest selling showroom. But aside from Studio Four, we haven't had very many showrooms that do very well with our line. I don't know why. We seem to be much better at selling it ourselves. Maybe because it's custom, I don't know.
I'm really curious about that. And I know you've got notions about the cost structure of going into a showroom. And I think that's interesting that you created, as you say, this PDF, this document that describes what you will ask showrooms to invest rather than showrooms asking you to make the investment of sending all the product and making that big investment. You've sort of turned the table somewhat on that and asked them to make that initial investment and then see how it plays out. But earlier you said to me that roughly 85% of your sales are direct sales, if I understood that correctly. And that's interesting to me because you have Studio 4 in New York that you've been with for quite some time, as you say, since the business began, almost 15 years, let's say. You also have a showroom in Texas. I don't know how long you've been with Supply in Texas. Is that a
Yeah,
long
I
time
think
or?
supply, I think it's been like 3 or 4 years. It's been since a couple of years after they opened, because they definitely asked us to be in their showroom when they first opened. And that was during
Okay.
the time when we were saying like we aren't taking any new showrooms. I think it just kind of evolved. I think when we first started, showrooms were in a bit of a different place than they are now. Anyway, because wallpaper was just, there was just a lot less wallpaper companies anyway, and wallpaper was not as popular as it is now. And we were so new. And I think Stacy and Kate had a lot of clients that they already knew. You know, they had a bigger client library or, you know, a bigger client list than I did. So they did really, I think when I was, you know, much, 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 much smaller, they did about a third of our business.
And we should say Stacy and Kate were the founders of Studio 4, just so people understand. And they had been in the trade business before launching that business, so they had a lot of clients and they had
Had
a
a
good
lot of
list.
clients and a good industry knowledge. And it's funny because their sales, it's almost like the same today as it was back then in the actual number. It's just that it's become like a smaller percentage of our full number. And I think the only reason, I think the difference between maybe SKL and some other brands is that we actually have a sales team. I don't think all, you know, textile companies want to have a sales team. A lot of textile designers might not want to have their own sort of sales office. I think that's why the showroom model works so well for a lot of designers, because they want to focus on their designs and their product development, but not on, you know, having a full service sales office or even a showroom. I mean, we have a showroom in Brooklyn, not in the city, but
right.
We have a space where you can come and see everything.
And is that an active space? Do a lot of people, so your space is in Williamsburg, we should say, and do a lot of people come to, I mean, a lot of people come to Williamsburg. Do a lot of people come to the SKL showroom in Williamsburg?
We do a good amount of appointments. It's definitely been hard to gauge. It was definitely different during COVID. And we just kind of redid the showroom because we had the same office, and it was really mostly office and just a smaller amount showroom. And then we got the basement downstairs, which is the same size as the upstairs. And we had decided to make the basement the rug showroom, but it just wasn't really flowing because people didn't really want to go downstairs and then back upstairs. We just recently made the upstairs the showroom, and we made the basement more of like a big work area. So I would tell everyone the showroom looks amazing right now, better than ever
before.
You should
totally come to the showroom.
We have a ton of rugs right now, and you should definitely come to the showroom. But I mean, we do we take appointments. It's not like super busy, but we have like, you know, a couple appointments a week. It's in Williamsburg, so not everyone wants to go to Brooklyn.
We're taking a quick break from the show to remind you to register for High Point Market. Fall Market begins October 22nd and runs through October 26th. You'll see the latest and best from top designers and brands, and you'll be able to renew friendships and make unexpected connections. Register now at highpointmarket.org. And now, back to the show. You raise an interesting point, which is part of the push-pull with, should I be in showrooms? Should I not be in showrooms? There's something magical about seeing product in real life. There's something magical about seeing fabrics and rugs, wallpaper installations. There's nothing like a beautifully executed showroom. But the other push in that is, gosh, but I'm doing all this business on my website and I can control that so much more easily. I don't have to worry about other relationships around the country. I can have my own salespeople, to your point. Some companies want to have their own salespeople, just as you were saying. Some people don't. Your own salespeople can present the product the way you want it presented. They can sell it the way you want it sold, and they don't have to take, and you don't have to give 30% or whatever the deal is these days to a showroom. Speak to me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think SKL is also different because we have so many, or we have more product categories than a lot of like similar wallpaper or fabric lines. We have, you know, we do pillows, we make all different sizes of pillows. And then we also have rugs, which is kind of like a completely different category. I mean, I know Studio 4 sells rugs, but we did explore selling rugs with them, you know, several times, and just the way it works with sampling and development and the way they deal with their samples. Actually, that's the biggest reason why we couldn't really do rugs with Studio 4 is because they give away rug samples. And my rug samples cost like $200 a piece. I don't give away rug samples to anyone. We have one of our most important spreadsheets in the office is the rug loan list. And it is like, who has what rug sample? And we're constantly like getting the sample back. So we can send it to another client and we take a credit card. If you want a rug sample, you have to give us your credit card. And if you don't return it, we will charge your card. I mean, it sucks because if we do lose a rug sample, it takes like 6 to 8 weeks to weave a new one. So not only does it cost $200, it takes a lot of time to get a new one. And we have multiple samples of really popular rugs, but I was telling you before, you know, developing rugs and developing a full line of rugs and having large rugs to photograph is super expensive. And I think that's why a lot of brands like me don't even try that. So anyway, trying to set up a showroom with rug samples was like even more difficult than trying to set up a showroom with wallpaper and fabric. So I think that's part of the reason why we have our own sales team, is because we just have a lot more product categories than some of our wallpaper colleagues or fabric colleagues. And I think it just comes down to relationships. I mean, I've been working with Studio 4 since the very beginning, and everyone knows we're there, and we have a ton of clients who are VIPs. They still always buy from Studio 4, but they've been buying SKL from Studio 4 for years. I'm friends with them. I know them. We reach out to them, but not to order from us. You know, we respect their relationship with Studio 4, and it works really well. And we've had other showroom relationships that just didn't work out, or they didn't have the clients that liked our brand. And then like with supply, like everything with supply has been going really great. But it's a kind of different situation because they came along after I was well established. So they wanted SKL more than I necessarily wanted to be in a showroom or set up a showroom. So it just worked out that I was able to leverage my position to sort of get them to work to carry my brand. And they've been amazing. They do really well. So I'm really happy with that relationship. And, you know, once you establish the relationship and you see like what the results are, then you can negotiate. Like, for example, we have this one line. It's like the earliest papers I did. They cost more and our margin isn't that great. So we couldn't offer like the full wholesale discount on those. And so we just weren't offering them to showrooms. But they really wanted to sell them because some of our popular patterns are on there. So after, you know, a couple years of like building a good relationship, then we worked something out so that they could sell those patterns as well. So it's just about relationships with showrooms, whether it's working or if it's not working, and just building it to see if it will work for both people. It's the same with exclusivities.
Right, which is another area that we should discuss, because yet again, you bucking the trend, resisting an industry norm. You said exclusivity. What the heck is that? And why would I sign on to that?
I mean, yeah. So I basically have never signed exclusivity with any showroom.
And so tell people what that means. So what, when showrooms want exclusivity, tell listeners what they're asking for.
So it's pretty standard that a showroom that's well established, for example, Studio 4 in a certain area, for example, the tri-state area or New York, they would offer a line exclusively through the showroom, which would mean that the brand itself could not sell in that area. So if I had an exclusive with Studio 4, it would mean like I couldn't sell through my office to their territory. Same with supply. Or we also work with Walnut Wallpaper and Salon Design. Salon mostly sells our rugs in Boston. That was actually interesting because she is moving to New York. She's a super good friend of mine, Amanda, from Salon Design, and it's a kind of more of a furniture showroom and a lighting showroom, and she's done really well with our rugs. But then when she was moving to New York, it got really complicated because I already have a team in New York that's actively going on meetings, selling rugs. So we just worked it out that she can still sell sort of like outside of New York because she has a lot of clients outside of New York that she presents rugs to. But I couldn't give her an exclusive in New York because I already have a team in New York. And then she's moving to New York and asking for, she didn't ask me for an exclusive because we're friends and she knew I wouldn't do it anyway. But yeah, for me, it has not been a choice that made sense.
Well, and interestingly, you just made the point too about the fact that you invest in PR, and that part of your feeling is, I've got someone who's working on publicity for my brand. And it's, if I remember correctly, how you've spoken about it in the past, you're getting a lot more publicity from your own person working on it than any of the showrooms have gotten for you in the past. Is that how you feel?
Yeah, I mean, not to say that I haven't gotten publicity from showrooms over the years. I certainly have. Also, I feel like depending on what the designs look like and how they sit, I think our product is really unique. Like it's kind of nothing else really like it. So maybe for some brands, it's great to be like sort of in the mix. I think for us, timing, you know, like if I'm not gonna lie, if you call SKL, you're getting SKL, and we have all the answers. We know exactly how to calculate our stuff. We know how it's made. We know what our lead times are. If you call a showroom, you know, unless you've got amazing people like David at Studio 4, he's freaking on fire and I love him.
Love him.
Know, they have to think about it. They're like, okay, I have like these 20 brands I represent. Like, what's the lead time for this one? What's the lead time for that one? I have to look at my spreadsheet before I can get back to this person. Like, it's a tough job being a salesperson at a multi-line showroom. Whereas if you're a salesperson at one brand, you know, you pretty much have all the answers. So I think that's just part of it is like, because we were able to have a sales team, which it was Nick, you know, it was just Nick for a long time.
Your husband, Nick, we should say for people.
Yes. You know, Nick would answer the phone and he had all the answers. And that's just pretty quick, you know? And also because we do a lot of custom stuff. So if you're working through a showroom to do something custom, it's like they're a middleman, you know? When if you call SKL, you can just talk to me and I will work with you on something custom. So I think it's just the nature of the beast.
Exactly. And as you were saying earlier, often a showroom plays a very nurturing role in the early development. And it sounds like you had that experience. It sounds like you learned a lot in the early days from Stacy and Kate, and they showed you the ropes a little bit, and you could make some mistakes, and you could try some things. And
oh yeah, for sure. I mean, they also helped us a lot with like our pricing structures and letting us know like what a typical discount might be for the trade. Our discount is 20% because their discount is 20%. We also had some difficulties, like, you know, I had just had all my prices on the website and then I was like, oh, I'm having a sale without telling them. And they were
I've marked down my prices.
They were like, you can't have a sale without telling us. How are we going to deal with this? What if people contact us with this new price?
And how did that get resolved? Because that is challenging.
Yeah. I mean, I told them, well, I think I should be able to have a sale if I want to have a sale. So I still did it. And we do one sale every year. But we have a format whereby we offer their clients the same sale price if they want to order through Studio 4, and then we split the SKL and Studio 4 splits the margin loss. I think that's how we do it.
You split it. So you found
somehow
a way.
It becomes fair for both of us.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll ask Stacy one time how she feels about that. We'll see if we get the same answer there. We'll let you know. But
she's used to it by now.
Well, right. Exactly. You've beaten her into submission, it sounds like, as you have with everyone, with, it sounds like. And why do you want to have a sale? What's the appeal of that for you?
Yeah. So the thing about the sale that makes it that I think Stacy's realized over the years and that we've helped explain to her too, is that the sale, it's almost like really for our retail customers because we have a lot of retail fans. But they can't like quite afford SKL. And they're looking at the retail prices, granted, and they don't get the designer discount. So our designer discount is 20% and our one sale a year is like Black Friday and then the weekend and then Cyber Monday. And it's for 30% off anything that's everything basically that we do that's custom. So the people who primarily shop the sale are retail clients who've been waiting all year for it. And then we also get a ton of designer clients who will buy for their own homes during the sale because they're getting a steeper discount than the trade discount. And then, you know, we have the big issues come when like a designer is working with a client and the client sees the sale and they're like, oh my God, I want to get this during the sale for this cheaper price. And then the designer's like, why are you doing that? Like that's the only time where we have issues, especially if it's like a showroom, a designer who's buying through the showroom whose client sees
and
it.
And wants the sale price. And yeah.
That's when it gets complicated.
But you find it's worth doing anyway, despite
possible. A crazy ton of business during
you
that
do.
Sale. Yeah, crazy amount of business. I mean, it's really, really good for us. And it's just once a year, you know. So I think, you know, we do have like a high-end brand. Our prices are not inexpensive. Everything's made locally. You know, we have some retail clients who've bought custom made rugs on that sale, which is, you know, it's like a big splurge that they've been planning for a year because they love this design. And I don't know. It's nice. I like doing the sale.
Okay, so you think you're making a connection with your people
Yeah.
during that time, and you're some aspirational people get a chance to own your product, and they might not otherwise be able to. It leads me to the question of the consumer, the homeowner in general. It sounds like it's still a very small portion of your business, but you do have these fans, as you say, that want to own the brand. The industry is convinced that there's no easy way other than through interior designers to service fabric clients, often even wallpaper clients. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably between like 6 and 9 or 6 and 8% of our business is retail. The rest is definitely trade. I mean, there's definitely a spirit of DIY, especially because of COVID. And there's also a lot of new places, like I can think of like Stitch Room or like sort of fabric people who will make pillows or upholster something. I mean, they're not just something somebody clicks and buys because it's daunting to think about that extra cost of the installation. I think
Sure.
that's actually one of the biggest challenges with our Mitchell Gold Bob Williams collaboration and sort of helping support their customers with like clicking and buying wallpaper since their business is actually mostly retail and not so much trade.
Yeah, and so let's talk about that since you mentioned the partnership with Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams, and that is exciting for you and to see your product out there in such a big chain. Tell us how that came about and how that's been for you.
They asked me to do it. They asked me to have a call, and they sort of acted like they were just vetting wallpaper companies because they wanted to partner with somebody, but they weren't sure who. And they asked me all kinds of questions about like my production capabilities, and I legitimately did not think that they were actually interested in working with me. I thought they were just like fishing around. And then later they asked me to do the collaboration, and they told me that I was like the only brand they wanted to work with. And I don't know if they were just telling me that to be nice, but
But that's nice to
yeah, no,
hear.
it was super cool. I mean, they gave me a ton of freedom on the designs, and I actually love the collection so much that I did for them that I was like, oh, I wish I had that in my line because it's only like you can only buy
It's
it through
only things
them.
you created exclusively for them.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it's collection exclusively for them that you would buy that you have to buy from them. But it's been interesting on this side of the collaboration, just helping them, supporting their sales team, and they have a lot of resources, like in terms of being able to give us numbers we can analyze. Like we have this many quotes out and this many stores, and like it's fun when we get to do that with them to see like how things are going. It's been awesome. It's been a really good experience.
We're taking a quick break from the show to hear more about Modern Matter. Dedicated to understated glamour and high quality, Modern Matter creates artisan-inspired hardware that is as elegant as it is durable. Their trade program was developed in partnership with leading interior designers and is focused on helping you make your next project successful and unforgettable. With trade-only pricing and a convenient sampling program, mix and match sizes, styles, metal finishes, and gemstones to fit each room's needs. Check out Modern Matter Hardware on Instagram or visit modernmatter.com to open a trade account and subscribe to their newsletter. That's modern-matter.com. And now, back to the show. Let's talk about the growth that you've experienced over the past several years. So earlier you were talking about you weren't growing very much and you wanted the ability to invest in some new technology and some other things that you wanted some money to put into some things, right? And so you said, let's grow. So what did you, even prior to COVID, right? So what did you do to kick growth into gear?
So I was telling you how we were kind of like flat for about 3 years. And I think what was interesting to me was we are always like doing about half our business in wallpaper. So wallpaper is really big for us. And I think people think of SKL as a wallpaper brand. But we had invested so much into rugs, and we had seen like a lot of growth in rugs, but it was just like it had started later, so it was very small. So I was seeing like a lot of growth in one category and not so much growth in fabric and wallpaper. So I just felt like we must have so much potential to grow more in rugs. Like I just knew that we could, and it seemed kind of like a no-brainer. And so what we invested in sort of pre-COVID was like a CRM system to keep track of our customers, and we redid our website. And when we started doing ads, like having a budget for social media ads and promotions, and we were working with a marketing consultant, and like it just felt like it was just lacking, and it just needed something to take us to the next level or to be seen as like a purveyor of luxury rugs. I just wanted like a new look, kind of, and I just knew I couldn't do it on my own. So I started working with my friend Natalie, who's done branding, and she redid our website. And then she started doing all of our mailers. Me and my art director, Olivia, we do like all the photography and like the copy, but then she does the graphic design for the mailers and the ads.
Okay.
So that, and then having like a database, like in the CRM system, like a way to keep track of things like how did people find out about SKL, or how mostly how did they find out about SKL, or just being able to measure things like how many samples we sent out, and how it correlates to like certain kind of sales. Like fabric has always been a little bit elusive to me. Like we've tried so much with fabric. We used to have such a big fabric business with ABC Home because they did couches upholstered with SKL fabric. There was like the whole second floor was like a freaking SKL floor full of couches made with SKL and like tons of pillows. And we had such a big fabric business with them. And then that slowly like dwindled because of things that were happening with ABC. So our fabric business, you know, we introduced a Jacquard and that ended up not doing very well. And we introduced a velvet and we had like production issues. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna give up on fabric for a little bit. I'm gonna focus on rugs, branding, got the CRM in place, which really helped us when everyone had to work from home. Yeah, and then we ended up having, you know, a ton of growth in 2020 and 2021. And interestingly, we grew the most kind of in wallpaper and then fabric and then rugs. We sold more rugs, but I think because we were lucky with some really large, expensive rug orders, our numbers actually weren't that much bigger in rugs. So I'm still on the rug train. I'm like, how can I sell more rugs? Because I also love designing rugs. But it's crazy how much wallpaper we sold during COVID. I mean,
During COVID, wallpaper sales just went through the roof.
I thought wallpaper was kind of at its level. I was thinking like there's so much competition, there's so many other brands now that make really cool
Right.
wallpaper. Like maybe we're just sort of at an im maybe this is as much wallpaper as we can sell. And I thought like my goals was like growing fabric and rugs, but during the growth years of 2020 and 2021, wallpaper went up a lot, like a surprising amount.
And how are you thinking about that growth? Are you suspecting, as many are, that maybe that has pulled forward a bunch of business that we might not therefore see in the rest of 2022 or 2023? Or are you thinking, okay, our business is now just at a higher level. We're just going to forevermore be doing more business and we're going to run it as if that business is always going to be there. How do you think about that?
Well, I think we did 34% growth in 2020 and 40% growth in 2021, or vice versa. I'm pretty sure 2021 was more, but I do not expect that percentage of growth this year. And based on what we're doing right now, we do not have that percentage of growth.
So have things slowed down? Have you started to see or just a leveling off?
We're kind of just like in line. We're in line
Okay.
with like last year. I'm expecting it to stay like that, but you know, I have no idea. I mean, I just don't have a bad feeling. I feel like one of the reasons why I'm not as worried is because the Mitchell Gold Bob Williams thing is new this year. That's like a new source of revenue. And then I still have high hopes for like rugs becoming a bigger category for us. So for me, those are two like giant potential areas of growth I have a plan in place for what I would have to do if sales dropped off.
And what's that plan? What would you
There's all kinds of ways I could downsize, and there's all
do?
kinds of things that Nick and I could take over doing again. We did everything before. I mean, right now I spend all my time doing like design and more high level. Like I work on like marketing and photo shoots and, fixing the website. I could stop. I could not fix the website and not pay someone a bunch of money to fix the website. I could cut down on advertising. I mean, I could cut down on all different ways. I could not give raises. There's so many things I could do. I would prioritize, keeping my team, because I think the people that are in place right now is what would help me grow. So I don't know. I just try not to worry about it too much. And
Well, and right now, I mean, it sounds like so business is sort of relatively stable to what it was last year, not the explosive growth that you were having. You were saying at the beginning of our conversation, you kind of just did your one-on-ones with everyone and you were sort of laying out some of the goals. So tell me what the goals are. What are you hoping for?
well, I really, really, really want to grow the rug program. I'm just absolutely obsessed with making rugs.
And is that because you personally love making rugs, and so you want them to sell so that you can make more rugs?
Basically, I love making rugs, but I started making rugs like 8 years ago, but I could only make three rugs. So my first collection, there was three rugs, and then the next one, there's like five rugs, and then that means I had eight rugs if I'm doing my math right. And so like finally I feel like, especially with the rugs that are coming out this year, which they're not coming out till fall, but I feel like I'm finally getting to a place where we have enough rugs that people would think of us as a rug destination. And I just feel like that's just taken so much time and so much work. And it's so technical and it's tactile. That's why I like it, because wallpaper is completely flat and wallpaper is easy to develop. You can just make a design and then print it. Rugs, it's like you have to get the color right, and you have to get the dyeing process right, and you have to like make a sample, and then you have to make a full rug, and then you have to figure out how to photograph it so that it actually shows like how amazing and luxurious the material is. So I love the process, and I love the rugs we're making, and I just feel like it's been a very long process, and it's going to continue to be. But we have done some amazing projects, and we have some amazing rug clients, and I'm always in awe of how they look like when we see the finished result.
And in the end, you've just outlined all of these challenges in bringing a rug collection to market and all of the things that you have to do to make it work. Is it a more profitable product line to introduce? Do rugs have a meaningful margin relative to wallpaper or fabric?
Yeah, I mean the biggest difference, I mean the actual profit margin is the same, but the biggest difference is that you have to do a higher volume of wallpaper to get to the same gross sales. But you could only sell a few rugs and make a lot of money. I mean, rugs are just epic. I mean, there's they're kind of less frivolous than wallpaper. For example, nobody needs wallpaper, but you need a light. So lighting has this great place in design where it's actually necessary. Rugs kind of get a little closer to that. They're a little closer to being like a piece of furniture or something that you actually need. So I like designing them for that reason as well.
Is Nick behind this? Is the numbers guy behind this push into rugs? Does he
He's
have
not the numbers guy. He just makes sure QuickBooks is up to
So
date. But
you're the
I'm the
numbers
numbers
person.
person. I make the whole spreadsheet of everything I want to know, and then he just like plugs the numbers in for me. But I make all the financial decisions of like what we're going to spend money on, and I'm the one who could tell you like what's in every single account, including how much of the line of credit I've used and how much of my SBA loan I have used. I could tell you the exact number in every account right
Well,
now, and he could
that
not.
is highly impressive. And have you found, now that you've grown into this much larger business, now that you have a line of credit, how does that all feel for you?
Honestly, I've had a line of credit for a while, but I last year was the first year that I didn't have to use it so much, and I was like, whoa. And then this year, I've been using it again, and Nick is like, oh, the line of credit is really high. And I'm like, honey, that is nothing compared to like so many years before this, where like I'm like, wow, I've maxed out everything. How am I gonna pay for rent? The amount of times that I have been like in the most risky situation with money is, it's almost always. That's why I do the finances, because I don't stress out about stuff like that. Nick is like super anxious and he just can't handle it. He'll be like, I can't believe you use this much of the line of credit. I can't believe he's like, we're going into a recession. I don't like where the credit cards are right now. Blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, dude, you need to chill out because that kind of energy is not good for like money flow. Like, you've got to let it flow. It goes out, it
That is
comes
bad
in.
feng shui when you're like thinking about money that way. Yes. Well, so are you worried about a recession since you're the numbers person, you're the money person, you're drawing down that line of credit? I mean, are you worried that a recession is coming? It's all over the news. The Fed's raising rates. What do you think?
I mean, yes, I'm aware of all that stuff. I think the reason why I don't get stressed about it is because I'm not unrealistic. Like I said, like it's kind of like how you should look at happiness. I think about if I had nothing, if I had to live under a bridge, or if I had to live on a beach or something, could I still be happy? And then I try to put myself in that position and think about what it would be like to just be happy with nothing. And I really try to feel what that would be like, and I try to convince myself that I could do that if I needed to, because happiness is the most important thing to me. And so when it comes to like SKL and money and running the business, I have a plan. Like I know what I would do if we suddenly went from having this many sales to zero sales. Let's say sales went down by 30%. Well, I have an idea of what I would do, but I'm not going to worry about it unless it happens. If it happens, then I will worry about it. I have a pretty good cushion right now. I'm not going to freak out if I have to use it, because I really like my team and I really like where things are at. And there's certain things I really want to do, and I just have to have the faith that if I continue to support my team and my business, that it will maintain itself. And I know that sounds like a lot of hoo-ha, and I don't have like an actual business plan like written out, but that's just how I've done it, and that's just what works for
Well, but
me.
it sounds like you do have a plan for how you will retrench if the slowdown really comes. It sounds like your priority is keeping your people. You've got lots of other ways that you can cut costs. It sounds like you have a cushion. So you might not have a Harvard Business School business plan, but you have a plan.
Yeah, I mean, I have a house and I have an apartment. I mean, I don't need both, I guess. If I had to get rid of one, I would get rid of one. And I have an office in San Diego and an office in New York. I don't need both. If I had to get rid of one, I would get rid of one. If I had to move my office back into my loft where it used to be, I would do that. And like, I don't know. I think I'd just deal with it if I had to deal with it. So that's why I try not to worry about it, because I think if you're always worrying about what you could lose, you're kind of like manifesting losing it. So just don't think about that too much, as long as
Right.
you have a plan.
So I think that's the great advice for people. Have a plan, but then
Don't worry about
don't,
it.
right? And maybe business isn't going to drop by 30%, and maybe you won't have to put that plan in place.
I don't think it's going to. I think it's gonna maintain, but who knows? I have no idea.
Well, I love that you have a plan, and I love that you're eager to do a lot of rugs in the year ahead. So we'll look for that. I'm so glad to get to talk to you at last.
Yeah,
And
me too.
yeah, I'm super excited. So thank you for making the time, and it's been a pleasure.
It's been such a pleasure. I'm such a huge fan of your podcast, and I've been listening to it for so long, and I just always wanted to be on it. So I'm really appreciative. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to keep up with the latest design industry news, visit us online at businessofhome.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, browse job listings, and join our BOH Insider community for access to online workshops, a free print subscription, and much more. If you have a note for the podcast, drop us a line at podcast@businessofhome.com. If you're enjoying these conversations, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps others to discover the show. This show was produced by Fred Nicolaus and edited by Michael Castaneda. I'm Dennis Scully. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.